Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show, where we help you win at the game of business and marketing so you thrive from the intersection of your brilliance and passion. My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. As the name says, we and our listeners are business creators. We have our entrepreneurs, small business owners, local business owners. We have marketing and business coaches. We have the folks who help others build their businesses. And we have the do-it-yourselfers who like to have your own hands on the levers. If you are any of the above, in fact, many of our listeners are all of the above, take a moment, go to our website, and find the episodes that best serve your quest towards experiencing your brilliance and passion. Also, check us out on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe so you get immediate access to over 250 episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to business creators just like you, and fresh content fed to your iTunes every single week. So this is going to be a very exciting interview, and the gentleman we have on board today is somebody who we have interviewed before. We spoke with him just about a year ago. His name is John Vespasian, and he spoke with us a year ago about success for low-energy people and the sequentiality approach. Now, this year, now that we have him back, we're going to be getting into sequentiality a little bit more and from a different direction. I found this topic very, very interesting when we covered it last time, and I wanted to bring him back so that he could share with us even more on the topic of sequentiality. So we're going to dive into that, and let me just say a little bit about John for those of you who were not here last time and for those of us who are just getting to know him. John is the author of 9 books about rational living, including When Everything Fails, Try This, Rationality is the Way to Happiness, The Philosophy of Builders, and the 10 Principles of Rational Living. Also, Rational Living, Rational Working, Consistency, the Key to Permanent Stress Relief, On Becoming Unbreakable, Thriving in Difficult Times, and his newest book, Sequentiality, the Amazing Power of Finding the Right Sequence of Steps. So again, welcome aboard, and we are going to go a little bit beyond what we covered last time. When it comes to speaking with John. In fact, last time what we spoke with him about was the 80-20 principle and not letting the 80-20 principle mislead you. We did cover sequentiality a little bit then, but now we're specifically going to cover sequentiality and how to get success for low-energy people. John, my friend, welcome back. Come on in. The weather's fine.
Hi. Thanks. Many thanks for having me on.
All right. So we covered this briefly a year ago, but let's get into detail now. Tell us, what is sequentiality? What do you mean by that?
Sequentiality is a pattern in personal development and in business development that shows that many people achieve extraordinary success and also extraordinary happiness just by finding a sequence of steps. Without being extraordinarily motivated, some people are not very motivated and they're just persistent, and eventually they come up with the right sequence of steps. Some people find it by chance, by trying different things. So what I have done in this book is to research a great number of stories, very, very large number of stories, biographies. Many of them are business people, and to show the patterns that have led people to success very, very often without having a very clear goal. And this is why I call the book Sequentiality, because I think it's more important to focus on the right sequence of steps than to be extraordinarily motivated. If you are very motivated, but you don't know what you're doing, basically you're wasting your time.
I understand. Now, you mentioned you tell a lot of stories in the book, and I myself am a big fan of stories. So can you give us a few examples of what you're talking about?
Yes. One of the patterns that you find in successful people that follow this sequence of steps is that whatever they do, even if they don't know what they're doing because they have a period of adversity. They are confused. Sometimes they don't have the resources. A pattern you find in all the successful stories I present in the book, and I think it's part of human nature, is that when you're facing confusing situations in business, in your private life, in your health, what you have to try to do, because it always works, given sufficient time, what you have to try to do is to build assets. To build assets in the sense of building relationships, building intellectual assets, building skills, building a social network, build assets. Even if you don't know what you're doing because you are confused, because your business is going down the hill, you don't know exactly what is the right marketing method, you have to build assets. And let me just give you an example from history that I found very impressive, because he's the archetypical person who doesn't know exactly what he wants in life. And this is the story of Alexander von Humboldt. The University of Berlin here in Germany is named after Humboldt. He was one of the most famous naturalists in the 19th century. And Humboldt started his career in a completely confused manner, because he went to university and got a degree in mining, in geology. He could not find an interesting job, so he ended up as a mine inspector in Germany. It was super boring because his job consisted of doing inspections and writing reports. So he didn't like it at all, but he could not find a better job. And eventually, he tried different things. He learned languages. He wanted to find a better job, but he could not find anything else. And eventually, his mother passed away. His father had died when he was an infant, but his mother passed away, and he inherited a small amount of money, what would be the equivalent of inheriting a house. I mean, you can inherit a few hundred thousand dollars, but it would not make you a millionaire. It could make you comfortable, could give you money to buy a new house, but that's it. He was not a millionaire. But instead of doing what everybody else would have done, which was to use the money to buy a new house or a new car, what Humboldt did was amazing, because he thought, okay, this job is super boring. I want to do something else with my life. I want to explore new countries. I want to find opportunities. And he tried to raise, he used his savings to raise money to explore South America, which in the late 18th century, 19th century, was still a known territory. He believed he could find new resources. And he went around, like you go to a venture capital company, he went around trying to find sponsors. And he went to Spain, and he failed. Then he went to France. He was rejected. He couldn't talk to Napoleon, so he was rejected. He wasted his money. He went to Belgium. He was rejected. He went to Germany, to different companies, mining companies. They all said no. So he wasted 1.5 years. He consumed 50% of his savings going the rounds, because he had to pay everything himself. So eventually he was faced with a very tough call, because he could go back to his job and say, okay, I give up. I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing this. Or he could take a risk. And he did something amazing, which is, with very little money, he just put the money in escrow, and he went to South America with another person interested in natural history. And they walk from Mexico to Argentina. They literally walk around the coast, taking notes, making drawings, talking to people. And when Humboldt came back to Europe, he didn't spend a lot of money. He spent about $60,000 in today's money. When he went back, he used the rest of the money to publish his notes, because he had taken copious notes, and he published 8 volumes, which he paid for himself. And this made him almost overnight the most famous naturalist in the world. And the rest is history, because Humboldt was so famous, he could get all kinds of assignments. He created a business from scratch, because nobody was doing that. Nobody was doing exploration in exotic countries. And he was hired by the Russian government to do a survey of Russian resources. And eventually, he lived very, very long. He was very, very happy. And this shows that even if he didn't know exactly what he wanted, because he didn't have a business plan, he didn't have a clear idea how he was going to make money out of the whole thing, but he had a clear sense of direction. And this is something that you find very, very, very often in people who become successful. They don't necessarily know the goal. Sometimes they change the goal as they move. But if you do like Humboldt and you create assets, because what Humboldt did was to transform his small amount of money into assets. And he created these books that are still published today in the 21st century. He became super famous, and the rest is history. So this is something that is a great example because it shows sequentiality at its best. You go step by step. You try to find a sequence of steps. You don't necessarily get it 100% right, but if you just keep going in the right direction, you will eventually see the light. And my book presents a lot of examples like Humboldt, showing that if you just keep going in the right direction, it's just a matter of trial and error.
Right. And you know what I found? This is a little bit of a motivational thing, and I know we have a lot to cover here, so I won't belabor the point, is I myself can go through periods where I'm feeling a little demotivated. And I know there's something within me, John, that causes me, when I know that when I'm about to take steps that are going to have a big impact, that sometimes causes me to, I don't know, pause or to take a moment before I make that big move because it could have a big impact on my business. It could have a big impact for a client. It could have a big impact for a member of my program. And I find that the best way to get motivated is just to get started. So let's say I have a project I need to work on, and I know that there are 20 steps of that project. And let's say step one is create the outline. So I open up a Word document. I type out 5 bullet points. Now I'm motivated because now I'm going back and I'm looking at, what are these 5 bullet points I just typed? Is this relevant? Is this part of the flow? Is this what I need to be doing? And just that process of my brain creating the end result drives me forward because I am now on the path.
Certainly, this is a way to go. What I show in the book is that many people don't even get to this level. They just try to pursue some kind of goal, very, very vague. They want to do something in a certain area. And eventually they just figure out how to make money out of it after going into different directions, making mistake after mistake. And just the pure persistence, even if they are not super cheerful, because many of these characters I paint in the book, portray in the book, many of these characters were quite low-key personalities. They were not super extroverts. But they just found a way because they wanted to do something. They wanted to work in a certain area and eventually made money. I mean, they became successful. Let me just give you another example. Look. Another story I cover in the book is the story of Jacques Cousteau, who was a very famous TV producer in the 1970s. He made the nature documentaries. Basically of submarine life. He was a world-famous oceanographer. And Cousteau also found the right sequence of steps basically by making mistakes and by disaster, because when he was young, he wanted to become a Navy officer. So he went to the Navy school in France. He was French. And he graduated. And he got his first job. I think he was second lieutenant in the Navy in France. But shortly after graduation, he had a very severe road accident. He was driving on the road, and the car skid, and eventually he broke his two arms and his two legs. And Cousteau was immobilized in the hospital for a very, very long period, and he recovered. Eventually, he could walk again with difficulty. And the doctor told him, look, if you want to recover the muscle strength that you have lost during these 6 months of staying in bed, you have to take up swimming because it's the only way to actually to regrow your muscles. And Cousteau didn't like swimming a lot. He found it a bit boring. But, okay, I mean, it was his only way to actually recover. So he obediently started to swim in the ocean. He found it still very boring. And to make it even something more interesting, he got some goggles and started to dive under the water. And eventually he became very curious about submarine life. He borrowed a camera, a camera that can make pictures underwater. And he started to make pictures. He got even more curious, and he actually got a camera. The first camera was experimental to make movies underwater. He started to make movies underwater. And one thing led to another. And within 2 years, he had made his first feature movie about submarine life. It was very primitive. It was a very, very rough movie. But still, it was the first submarine movie ever made. He presented in a couple of festivals. He got some acclaims and good reviews. And he started from there. And he just went making movie after movie. And in a few years, he was making so much money that he quit his job at the Navy. He became a full-time producer, making naturalist documentaries about nature, about the environment. And he continued to do that for the next 40 years with huge success. So this shows you that sometimes it's not having a plan, it's not having a clear idea what you want. It's just when you get an opportunity and you find the steps you are not expecting, you just follow the way and try to make the best out of it. And Cousteau made the best out of a very severe road accident. Instead of becoming completely desperate and completely depressed, he just took up swimming and then diving and then photo making and then movie making and then became a millionaire. So the stories of sequentiality are not straight. They are not based on clear goals. They are not based on clear patterns of going from A to B. What they show is that if you follow opportunities, if you follow your interest, eventually you will get to something.
I agree with all of that. Now, you raised another point to me a little while ago, and I wanted to share this with our listeners. These are great stories. To me, in some ways, they are inspirational and motivational. If anything, they're educational. Now, in your books, you have shared that you have some skepticism about positive thinking. Tell us more about that.
Yes, well, I have nothing against positive thinking as such, but I think you should not just get focus on the thinking. You have to also do the actions, and you have to really make an effort to find opportunities. And I find it a bit sad that in our culture, we are so much focused on the positive thinking, on the dreams, on the beliefs. I think this is important, but it can be misleading. And what I have done in the book is to show a story after story that not everybody who becomes successful is super positive. Some people just become successful out of sheer indignation because they're doing something and they want to improve their lives. They want to get in a different situation. They want to make more money. They want to have more fun. And eventually they find the sequence of steps that leads them to the place they want to be, even if their goals are very fuzzy. So positive thinking is good. I think it's good to be motivated, but you have to take the actions. And most of the time, people are going to find the steps only when they're already walking. The idea that you can open a Word file and decide, okay, I'm going to follow these one, two, three, four, five steps. It can happen if you know the field very, very well. You have 20 years of experience in the field and you know exactly what you have to do. But most people don't have that much experience when they're starting out. And they have to learn by experience. They have to learn by trial and error. You will be very fortunate if you can make bullet points and identify all the steps. But this would be extraordinary. Most people will not be able to do that.
Right, right. Very interesting. Now, I'd like to get a little bit into some of the themes that we see through some of your works. And as we know, you've written 9 books so far. There may be other books in the future, but you have a body of work that I find very interesting. And it's the reason why we've been very happy to have you to the Business Creators Radio Show twice so far. And hopefully we'll have you back next year as well. One of the themes that goes through your books is an emphasis on health and longevity. And why do you place emphasis on health and longevity in your books?
Yes, because I think when you write books about practical philosophy, you can call it personal development, you can call it any way you want, but basically it's practical philosophy. You have to show the whole picture. And one thing that I find super annoying when I read books about psychology, about personal development, is that they give you a lot of tricks about how to develop your business or how to do something better. But you have to see the whole thing in the context. And it doesn't really help if you become super motivated and super hardworking and you work 20 hours a day and then you get a heart attack and then you die before you are 50. This is not a good approach. So I think that when you, when you're giving business advice or marketing advice or you're trying to teach personal finance, it has to be shown in context and it has to be given a twist. It has to be given a focus from the whole aspects of human life. And the first thing I check when I'm looking at the story of a biography, the first thing I check is how many years, how old did this person got? Did he get to 50, 60, 70, 90? When it gets to 90, I start to become very interested because he was successful as a business person, but he was also very wise in his lifestyle. He managed to live 80 or 90 or 100 years old, and I think there is a lesson to be learned from that. And most of the stories I try to present in the books, in my books, they are about people who live very, very old. For me, it goes together with wisdom because it's not just about making money. It's not just about being successful or being famous. If you do not become very old, and I'm talking about at least 80, 90, if you can live 100 years old, much better. Yeah. If you don't have this in mind, you might be going the wrong direction because you are burning, we say, the candle on both sides. This is not a good idea. So this is why I always talk about health in my books. They're not books about, they're not medical books. But I always make an emphasis on longevity because it's very important. Don't believe people who lived 50 years and then they are very, very rich, but it's not a good example to follow.
Right, right, right. Very, very true, very true. Now, going along with that topic, you've also shared that millions of people, and I think this is very true, there are millions of people in the world who feel so depressed that they can barely function. What is your take on that?
Yeah, the problem has been going on for already for decades, but it's getting worse and worse. I recently read a statistic that only in the U.S., there are 50 million people taking medication against depression, stress, anxiety. So if it's 50 million in the U.S., possibly worldwide, it's going to be at least 200 million. I mean, it's really a huge amount of people. And what is the reason behind? Because you cannot really say it's a chemical problem, that they are not taking enough medication. There is something behind. And what I have found in research, in historical research, is that most of the time it's going to be a set of ideas that is very unrealistic. People have expectations or they have a certain logic in their heads that is not working. And then they become passive, they become paralyzed, they become depressed, anxious, and then they sabotage their own initiatives. This is a huge problem because if you're running a company and you have a couple of employees suffering from depression, it's going to be very expensive for you because they would come to work from time to time, then they would have to be on sick leave, and then they come back again. You don't really know what to do with them. They can even pollute the atmosphere of the enterprise. See, this is a very, very serious problem. And the only solution I can tell you from history is that people only get better when they change their set of ideas and they become more realistic. Not necessarily more enthusiastic, but at least more realistic. And in my latest book, In Sequentiality, I present a few examples of how to avoid this situation. Let me just give you quickly one of the stories. Look, one of the reasons that makes people depressed and anxious is that they're hypersensitive. And hypersensitivity Sometimes it's presented as a virtue because I say people, oh, you are very sensitive. But it could be sheer stupidity. And there are many examples of people who destroy their lives, even if they have a lot of talent, a lot of resources, a lot of opportunities. They just destroy their lives because they are hypersensitive. They cannot stand failure. They cannot stand negative criticism. They cannot stand a bad review on Google and newspaper or on Amazon. And this is not good. You have to be balanced. You have to be a bit tough in life. Hypersensitivity is not a virtue. It's a sickness. And one of the stories I present in the book is the story of Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who was one of the most interesting painters, artists in the 19th century in the United Kingdom. He was very talented. He was a painter. He was a poet. The problem with Rossetti is that he destroyed his life because he was hypersensitive. He got a few bad reviews to one of his paintings, and he became an alcoholic. He became addicted to substances. And basically, then he went downhill until he died in his early 50s. A complete disaster. I mean, the guy was a genius, but he could not cope with failure. He could not cope with negative criticism. And this is, for me, the reason behind this massive wave of depression. People are very unrealistic. They expect life to be easy. They expect their dreams to become true. Too easily, and this is not realistic.
Wow. Wow. And you know what I've noticed, just one of the other themes that just sort of occurred to me as I've listened to you speak for these past 25 minutes is your reliance on the lessons of history. And I'd like to go there for a moment if we could. In fact, what I've noticed having perused some of your books is that your books are based on history. So why should we care about things that happened a long time ago? I'm reminded years ago I ran into this person I know, and she said, what do I care about history? That's what happened yesterday. I care about what's happening right now. I couldn't even continue the conversation because I myself get it, but I want to hear from you, John. Why do we need to care about what happened a long time ago?
Well, there is a logic in the question. If you say, okay, why do I care? I mean, it happened in another country. It happened in another century. It happened to different people, people of different, to speak different languages, different cultures. But the idea behind is that human beings remain the same through the centuries. And we make the same mistakes. It doesn't really matter if you are using smartphones or you are using a typewriter, or you are using ink and a pen, it doesn't really matter. We make essentially the same mistakes. And this is why I think that if you can learn from history, you will save yourself a lot of trouble. You will spare yourself a lot of suffering in life because you don't need to make the same mistakes. Let me just give you an example from the book about learning from history and how critically important it is. Look. In the early 20th century, there were several people trying to explore and to find the South Pole in Antarctica. And there were several expeditions from the UK, from England. There was another one from Scotland, another one from Norway. And these people, they had a lot of resources. I mean, you are talking about millions of dollars of sponsorship. They went there with ships. They had a crew of 50 people. So really, it was a huge undertaking. And they wanted to go to the South Pole to find it because they thought there were resources there. They wanted to plant their flag. And many of them died. And they died in horrible circumstances because they got frozen. They lost everything. They were completely abandoned. It was a complete disaster. Some of them are even still there because they could not even recover the bodies. And there was a guy from Norway, Amundsen, who just went there. And it was like a walk in the park. He did everything right. He went to the right place. He used the right technology. He went there and came back. And all the other people, they froze and they died. And when they asked this guy, okay, Amundsen, how was it possible that it was so easy for you? And all the rest died. And it was very modest. And Amundsen said, look, I'm not a genius. I just check what other people were doing in similar circumstances, and I learned from them. And by checking, by simply asking, he was the only guy in the whole undertaking who actually found what kind of clothes do you need to wear in Antarctica. He figured out you have to wear furs, because if you wear textiles, you will get wet and you freeze. And he was the only guy who figured out you have to wear furs, because the English and the Scottish, they were wearing wool, and they all froze. It was terrible. And Amundsen was the only guy who figured out the right kind of ducks. And he said, okay, what kind of ducks do I need to take to Antarctica? And he bought the ducks in Siberia. And they are right. Ducks that were already used to low temperatures. And the stupid English, they bought ponies. And they took the ponies from Argentina to Antarctica. And the ponies broke a leg and they died. It's a terrible story, but it shows you have to learn from history. Because these people died because they didn't check, they didn't learn from history. They tried to improvise. And Amundsen organized the whole thing in a couple of months. He made a checklist, he learned from history, and he won. So don't make stupid mistakes. You can easily research what other people have done in similar circumstances. Of course, I guess you're not going to go to Antarctica as a business venture, but the mistakes human beings make every single day, most of them can be avoided if we learn from history.
See, that's what I've been saying. You know, what I've discovered in my years as an entrepreneur, in my years as a business owner, in my years as doing copywriting work, that a lot of the lessons that I have found to be most effective to advance me as a business creator come from reading autobiographies, because it's great to listen to theories about how things should be and analysis, but I have found that some of the greatest lessons that you can find are when you listen to the person or read the person say it in their own words, because only they were there and only they have the unique combination of experiential learning, development, and worldview that informs how they acted in that situation, how they reacted to that opportunity. So some of those lessons I found to be very powerful, and that is a study of history, because these are folks who live through history, help create history, and now we're learning directly from them. That's just my own personal observation.
Yes, and let me just give you another story that shows a pattern that is absolutely not self-evident. Because today in the 21st century, when we talk about success, about business success, we also have the idea that you have a goal, you have a strategy, you have a business plan, and you implement it and you just go for it. And eventually you just find a way to do it. Sorry. And it is not always so simple. And one of the stories that I found super interesting when I did the research for the book is the story of Giotto. Giotto was a painter in the 13th century, and in the 12th century. And Giotto has a pattern of success that is very unusual. I find it very, very wise to learn. Because what happened to Giotto is that he developed a career as a painter. He had a workshop in Florence, and he got most of the commissions from the church, because most of the paintings in the 11th, 12th century, they were commissioned by the church. But Giotto found his work very boring. He was very talented, very innovative as a painter, but the commissions he got, they were, most of them, very repetitive, because painting in the late Middle Ages was very, very dark, very rigid. And Giotto was super creative. So eventually he got a commission, a very unusual commission, in Padua. It's about 200 kilometers from Florence. He got a commission from an aristocrat whose father had died, and his father had been very, very evil in life, and he wanted to build a chapel to expiate the sins of his father. So he hired this Giotto to paint the chapel. So look, you come here, you just paint whatever you want. I want to devote this chapel to the memory of my father. And Giotto went there for the first time in his life. He was already 35. He got a commission where he could paint whatever he wanted. And he went to Padua, and he spent 2 years. He put scaffolding inside the church to be able, because he was very small. He was only 5 foot. I mean, he was a really very small man. And he painted the church in a very, very innovative way. He painted emotions in the figures, in the faces. He painted very dramatic scenes. And everybody was amazed because nobody had done this before the 12th century. He was a total innovation. He was, in the sense, like someone creating a new product or a new trend. The problem with Giotto is that when he came back from Padua, after painting this amazing painting, you can still see it there, and they are used very often in Christmas cards still in the 21st century. For the rest of his life, and this is a very important business lesson, for the rest of his life, he had to go back very much to the old style, because he realized that what he had done in Padua was one opportunity in a lifetime. He got the opportunity to do whatever he wanted without any constraints. And for the rest of his life, and he lived still another 25 years, he tried to find opportunities to do this kind of innovative painting, but he never found it because the market was not there. Eventually, he came back to the previous technique, which is very boring, which is very predictable, but he made a living. He created a very solid business, a very solid workshop that he passed to his children, who continued to become to get an income from their paintings. So in the end, he had to make a choice between wild innovation, for which there was no market, and predictable, solid work, for which there was a huge market. And this is something that many business people find difficult to understand, that you might be too much ahead of your market. And this is a very difficult lesson to learn. It was very difficult for Giotto to learn this lesson, to accept that he was ahead of his time, at least by 50 years. But you have to realize that you might be operating in a market where your products or your services, they are too complex, they are too sophisticated, they are too too excellent. And you might have to reduce your level in order to find the customers you need.
Right. And what I love about your approach, John, is, again, it's the storytelling approach. Pretty much our entire interview has been me asking questions and you telling these stories. And it does tie back to this idea of sequentiality and the idea of success for lower energy people, because it shows that just coming up with that burst of energy is not the only way you can go about getting things done and moving things forward. So we're studying history. We're looking at health and longevity as a way of facilitating people moving forward. We're looking at positive thinking, your thoughts on it, and more. So what I'd like to do now is, since we're dealing with low energy, I want to shift gears again, since we have about 20 minutes left here. And I want to ask the question of, in your estimation, let's say a person is overstressed. They're weighed down, they're frazzled, they're just totally wiped out with stress. What can they do right now to reduce those levels of stress?
Yeah, the only thing that works, and this is proven by a lot of stories about people who have improved their lives, the only thing that works is to make your life consistent and to try to identify what are the areas of your life that are inconsistent and try to remove those inconsistencies. The inconsistencies can be very subtle. It's not always self-evident to say, okay, I'm trying to do too many things. I should do fewer things. Yeah, okay, but are the things consistent? Are you going in the right direction? Are you trying to do what is important? And sometimes it takes a lot of analysis, a lot of thinking to figure out what is really the reason for the stress. We tend to avoid this kind of thinking because we feel it's like a waste of time. It's difficult when you're really having a lot of work, you're having a lot of activities. It's difficult to find a couple of hours to actually think and say, okay, what I am doing wrong? Why I'm feeling so stressed? Why do I have difficulties sleeping at night? But there's another way. You have to really take a pen and paper and make a list of what you're doing every day and try to figure out what the problem is. And the problem sometimes is going to be invisible. It could be that you are worried about some risk in your business, and it is not conscious, it might be unconscious, and you are trying to cover the risk without actually thinking about it. It might be relationship problems, and you're having problems with some person, and you don't want to address the problem because it's very uncomfortable, and you just develop more and more activities in order to avoid difficult conversations. So don't assume that it's super easy to find the reason for stress, because it is not simply that you have too much to do. Look, if you have too much to do, but you are organized and you have a very consistent approach, you will not get stressed. You will delay things, you will have priorities, you will have a system for dealing with the work, and you would feel actually happy because you are so successful that you have so much work that you can decide on the priorities. So it is not a question of quantity. It is not that you have too many activities, too many emails. In the end, you can find ways to deal with those. What creates a massive amount of stress in human beings is inconsistency. And this is something that I go back to the idea of sequentiality. Inconsistency destroys sequentiality. And let me just give you a quick story of a person who destroyed his life. After building a very successful sequence of steps, he destroyed his life within a couple of years because he became very stressed. And this is the story of Charles Dickens. He was a very famous author in the 19th century. And Dickens, it took him about 10 years to develop a system for writing bestsellers. And he was very, very organized. He would write 3 pages every day. He knew how to create very interesting characters. So he developed like a small literary machine. And he produced a book every year. Year after year, he became very, very wealthy. The problem with Dickens is that at a certain point in his life, he was in his early 50s, he made a huge mistake that created a huge inconsistency. And he became very stressed. And the mistake is the following. I don't know why exactly, but he became too bored with his work. He wanted to do something else. And he came to the idea that he wanted to write for the theater, which was completely stupid because he was the most successful author in Europe. But he wanted to be a playwright. He wrote a play that was really very boring. He tried to find the producer. Nobody would want to stage the play in London. So eventually he used his money to stage the play with some amateur actors. And he hired a professional actress for the leading role. And there the disaster started because the actress was 25 years younger than Dickens. He became infatuated with her. Dickens was married and he had 5 children. And what happened then was a disaster after disaster because he kept his mistress in a house. Then he had his own house with his family, and the guy was going back and forth all the time. He was completely paranoid about the press because he didn't want the press to know about his mistress. Eventually, the wife found out and he moved out. So he has to pay for 3 houses. He has to pay for the wife and the children. He has to pay for his own house and then the house of the mistress because they could not live together because he was afraid of the newspapers.
Right.
And he was so stressed that he became severely sick. He was not even able to write anymore. He wanted to make more money because he spent so much money. He had to keep 3 households. He started to give public readings of his books to make more money. He became very, very sick. He went to the U.S. When he was back from the U.S., he was almost dying. And eventually he got a brain stroke and he died. It was a complete waste because he was a genius. But he actually messed up with success. He found the right way to become successful, but then he destroyed everything because he became distracted. He became stressed because he was living a life that was very inconsistent.
Wow, that is something. So we have consistency, sequentiality. These are all interesting things. Now, going back to what you were saying earlier about levels of stress and things like that, I want to test a theory with you since I have you here as a subject matter expert. In my own book, which is titled Groundhog Day is an Event, Not a Business Strategy, twice in the book I include the same subsection, which encourages the business creator to look at the processes they have in their business, their roles, their regulations, their step one, step two, step three for doing certain things, the items on their to-do list, and look at each one of those items and ask this very important question. Do we need to be doing this? Do I have to do this? So rather than look at what can we do to simplify things, what do we need to do to reorganize things, maybe the question we need to ask is, do we even need to do this stuff at all? What would happen if we just didn't do it at all? Would anybody even notice? Would anybody even care? Would any money be lost? Could money be made? That's a question I just don't see asked very often. So I want to get your thoughts on it as a subject matter expert.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent approach. Not only in business, I think it's applicable to many things we do in life. And it reminds me when I bought my first robot for the vacuum cleaner. I bought some time ago, and now all my friends have one because I realized, okay, I was paying someone to clean up the house, and now with a robot, the robot is going to do 50% of the work. So eventually, if you can figure out how to skip a task, either by subcontracting or by not doing the task at all, or by doing half of it, or by doing less of it, I think it's a very good move. But for most people, the problem is not optimizing. The problem is getting there. And getting there is a very messy, sometimes very unpredictable approach. And I would like to have the luxury sometimes to take a look at an operation and say, okay, what can I improve here? What kind of task can I delete? What kind of activities can I leave out? But if you're struggling, trying to get the business off the ground, or you're trying to get your career off the ground, sometimes you just have to try everything. You don't have the possibility to optimize. You have to go for it. And it's sad that we don't have sometimes the tools to figure out the solution. But that's human life. We never have enough knowledge. Nobody knows everything of everything. And you have to try to figure out how to do it. And let me just give you quickly an example.
Right.
Look, one of the things that is super annoying for people, for business people and for, I would say, people in general, is that you might be trying to become successful at the business, at the profession, at the career. For many years, you might be working very hard. You might be highly educated, highly motivated. You might be very positive, but still, you're not getting there. And there might be a reason, and you have to face it, and it's very difficult to acknowledge that most of the time when people are super motivated, super hardworking, super organized, and they don't get the kind of success they want, it is because they're in the wrong place. And the wrong place might be in the wrong company, in the wrong field, and most of the time it could be in the wrong place, geographically. And one of the stories I tell in the book is the story of Casanova, who is well known to be a great seducer of the 18th century, but Casanova was also very wealthy. And he started with nothing. He started from scratch. He became a millionaire, And he only managed to make money because he was really struggling. He was getting fired from jobs, job after job. He was really struggling. He only made money when he moved to France, because in Italy, he was born in Venice, it was a disaster. I mean, he got sued. He got all kind of problems. He got fired from his job. And eventually, when he moved to France, and he could not even speak French when he went to France. He went to France. He learned French. And he started as a consultant. To organize a lottery in France, because he knew the lottery in Italy. So he actually took the idea to the government in France. He organized a lottery, and he became a millionaire within a couple of years. And this is something that in business is very difficult to accept, that you might be trying very hard, but the market is not there, and you might need to move to a different market or to a different location. And then your efforts will be rewarded.
Great. I love all that. Now, speaking of energy, and this is something that I thought of a moment ago as I was listening to you, and I know it's a little bit of a change of topic in the last few minutes we have here, but I think this would be a good place to help people who are finding issues with their energy. And I think some of it comes from the internet, especially when we talk about entrepreneurs. A lot of us are on the internet all day long. We don't have the same restrictions on where we can go on the internet because we don't work for corporations. I can go to any website I want to any time of day. So, yeah, there's nothing that keeps me off social media or any website I want to visit or anything like that. So what we've also seen is that, wow, the internet, not only is it causing people to lose energy, but it's also failing to make people more tolerant and wise, which itself I think is an energy sapper. Why do we think this is happening? I think it's a very valid topic and a place we need to go in the time we have left. What is the internet doing that's failing to make us more tolerant and wise?
Well, we have the fantasy that with more resources, we can easily do more. This is most of the time is not true. And it happens very often that people win the lottery and within 2 years they are destitute. It happens very often that sports people, they become very wealthy within a few years and then they lose everything by making stupid investments. The internet is exactly the same story. I mean, in the 1930s, it happened very often that millionaires, they started libraries, and they created libraries for poor people.
Yep.
So
they,
people could read books, and they have the idea that if people could read books, the problem will be solved because people will have access to education, and then everybody will be very clever. And it was a complete failure. Nobody read the books. Very few people go to the library. And the internet is exactly the same. You have this access to information. You can read books. You can read videos. Instruction videos. You can learn almost anything you want on the internet. But what is the average internet user doing? They are watching videos of cats, or they are just looking at some sports, or watching some soap opera on the internet. And this is how people spend their time. The opportunity to learn, or the opportunity to develop a business, the opportunity to grow as a person in knowledge, in connections, in resources, is wasted because it is not used. And it has happened in history that every time that there are new opportunities, there are new countries, and say, oh, everybody's going to America and they're going to make money. Many people did not go to America. They stayed in Europe and they starved. And every time there is a new opportunity, say, oh, everybody will do this. But most people will not. And this is human nature. And we have to be very conscious that the availability of resources itself does not guarantee success. It's a fantasy. Most people who create very successful businesses, they don't inherit the money. They don't have many resources. They just start little by little. It is not access that guarantees success. So the internet is a very wise to take it as a tool, but it can multiply your strengths, but it will also multiply your weaknesses.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation. I've found that in many cases that being online and is actually dehumanizing in some ways, because we aim our thoughts and our reactions to the avatar that has been created. And what sometimes gets lost is there's an actual living, breathing, feeling human being behind that avatar. So what we see happen way too often is folks will argue with a complete stranger and make cast aspersions on that complete stranger's character, thought processes, morals, and all that. And if you start to think that there's a person back there, so both giving and receiving is a big energy drain when you think about it. Because even for the resilient person, getting beat that way leaves bruises. And for the person who's giving out that energy, couldn't you be putting that in a different place? I mean, that doesn't seem like a very sequential approach to success, if you ask me.
Yeah, you're perfectly right. But we have to discipline ourselves, and we have to use the energy and to use the time effectively. And I don't know how many millions of hours are spent on internet watching porn or watching stupid videos, but that's human nature. And the ancient Greeks, I was just reading Sophocles the other day, I was reading a tragedy, and they complained that people didn't use their time wisely, that people wasted their time and wasted their lives. In the 21st century, it is exactly the same. And the internet is a blessing, but it's also damnation. Because if you use the internet for sending, stupid photographs the day after day without actually getting anything done, it's not a blessing. It's a distraction that is basically preventing you from getting anywhere.
Exactly. So as we wrap up here, John, I first of all want to thank you so much for being with us once again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the Business Creators Radio Show. And for our listeners who may be interested in sequentiality or working on stress relief, becoming unbreakable, thriving through difficult times, and some of the other very important topics that you share with the world, how can the person take it to the next level with you? Is there a way to contact you? Is there a way to get your books? What would you recommend being the next step for somebody who finds this interesting and wants to take it?
I'm super easy to find all my materials. If you just type John Vespasian on Google or Yahoo, you just type John Vespasian, you will have immediate access to my blog. This is a free blog with hundreds of articles. This is a free newsletter. And you can also find my books. They are available on Amazon. They're available on different outlets. Just type John Vespasian on Google. You will find everything in 1 second.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much, John Vespasian. Thank you very much for being with us today. It's been an honor and an education. We hope to have you back soon.
Many thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me on.
For everybody listening, this is Adam Homey, host of the Business Creators Radio Show. Please check out our previous and our upcoming episodes at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com, where we help you win at the game of business and marketing so you thrive from the intersection of your brilliance and your passion. Until next time, have a great day. Take care. And that's it. Okay, so let me see here if you're going to be up soon. We should have this episode out. Oh, yeah, your date's already been picked. John, this will air on Tuesday, July 6th.